Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on Sirius XM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Being a musician isn't all about fame and fortune. With the music industry constantly changing, sometimes making albums and going on tours can actually cost artists. Working to change that is a new program from Artist Growth and Pinnacle Financial Partners that provides financial services to the touring industry. We're going to learn more about that program from Artist Growth founder Matt Ermey. Then Generation Z is shifting the way that money and volunteerism flow in the nonprofit sector. On the cusp of going through the largest intergenerational wealth transfer ever, this generation is going to have a major impact on the future of philanthropy. We'll talk about how inheritance is influencing the business of philanthropy with Karma and Sense Gina Rotstein. And more millennials are choosing to stay at home longer, not get married, have children later, if at all. But how do these life choices influence their investment decisions? We'll go through the OSC's new report on the investing obstacles facing millennials with the director of its investor office, Tyler Fleming. Plus, we'll look at a website called The Answer Is. It provides young people with basic knowledge to successfully invest for themselves. And we'll learn more about a new medical marijuana program from Manulife and Shoppers Drug Mart. All that's ahead. Let's get started. A musician's lifestyle is not necessarily the pinnacle of glamour. It isn't all A-list parties, massive world tours, enough money to buy whatever you want whenever you want. Of course not. Unless the artist is already successful, sometimes concert tours can actually cost them money. A new tour financing program has launched from Artist Growth and Pinnacle Financial Partners. We're going to talk about it with Artist Growth's founder and chief strategy officer, Matt Ermey, joins us from Nashville, Tennessee. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
How does this program work?
So the first thing that we wanted to do that was most important to me was that artists needed to be able to access money even if they had personal bad credit or no real history. But if they were willing to go out on the road, that they would be able to access the capital they needed to fund it or maybe fund some other business initiative like making an album or making a video. And so what we did is we partnered with Pinnacle, who caught the vision right away. And basically, we will advance them money for the guarantees that they have for their booked shows. So if their agent books them, 100 shows in a year, whatever the grand total of all the guarantees are for those shows, we'll advance them a percentage of that based on the tour history that they have and the size of their business, et cetera. And then they can use that money for any business purpose that they have, whether that's, to buy gear, pay for production, make an album, make an EP. But it doesn't require them to have a great credit score. We don't even look at their personal credit score. We don't look at their tax returns of their business. It's really just, do you have a tour booked? Did your agent book you a tour? What's the total sum of the guarantees and how much money do you need?
What was the toughest part of figuring this model out? It's not like you're trying to fund a Dunkin' Donuts franchise that has, historic financials and benchmarks and all that kind of stuff. What were the hardest parts to think through?
Well, the most important piece was to have a clear understanding of how the booking process works, getting the bank and our financial backers in the program to really understand how the booking process works, and then once a show is performed, how those guarantees are collected and how they're paid out to the artists and all of the other, business expenses and partners that the artist has. And so that we just had to sit down with the agencies that we're partnered with on this and talk it through. That was the most sort of manual process, but I wouldn't call it hard. It was just really detailed.
What does the artist have to pay in terms of a premium for this kind of financing, given that it is a bit out there? It's not like you're getting a loan to buy a car. It's a little more complicated, and I would assume that the lender would require a higher rate of return than they would on a car loan.
Well, potentially. And in some instances, they'll get a much lower rate than they would on a car loan. Really, depending on the tour history that an artist has, and the size of their business, they could actually get a rate on this advance or this loan that's well under market if they just walked into a bank off the street and said, hey, I want to borrow $50,000. Now, some tours, maybe it's an artist's first tour and they have no history. So, the lender might look at that as a bit more risky than somebody who's done, you know, successful tours every year for the last decade. And so that interest rate could swing up a little bit, but the goal, and this was really the second most important thing, is that we don't really get above market ever. The idea was, you know, we're not trying to squeeze money out of them for this. We're trying to create a program that gives them leverage to make the right choices with their business. And then we have other ways that we can serve them, you know, through the software, or the bank has additional services. So this is really built to be an extremely artist-friendly program.
You talked about the guarantees. Now, does this mean that if a tour bombs, it's of no consequence to the lender?
Well, the lender is certainly taking on a lot of the risk. And part of that initial upfront diligence that we did when we spoke about with the agents about the process of booking shows and collecting on shows is we looked at a lot of data on the amount of tours that don't actually happen and don't get paid out on. And in most cases, when that doesn't happen, it's because, you know, the artist is sick or gets injured, but they eventually end up happening and it just sort of phase shifts out into the future. It was actually a pretty low percentage of tours that actually get canceled and never happen again. And we work closely, you know, with the artist business manager, who's really their accountant and their financer, to make sure that they don't borrow so much. There's actually limits on the program that prevent them from being able to borrow such a high amount against their guarantees that they end up underwater on day one. We don't want that. We don't want artists to lose money. We want them to be able to get early access to their money so they can invest and grow.
What has changed about the music industry that makes this both an opportunity and a necessity? Is the record labels used to do this and now they don't anymore? Or what dynamics have changed that underscore the opportunity of this?
That's part of it. Tour support is harder to come by for a lot of acts, especially acts that are still in the emerging phase. You know, I mean, really established, you know, legendary and famous acts, they don't have a problem getting access to money. Maybe they do have to pay a premium sometimes, but they can get money. The working bands, the working artists who are still emerging, they can really struggle to get tour support. But another trend that's emerged is because touring has become the driver of profitability for most artists. That's where a lot of the money is being made. A lot of investors, whether it's a label or whether it's a promoter or whether it's just a private individual, they're willing to advance those tours and lend into them, but they do it for equity in the artist's intellectual property, so a piece of their merch business or a piece of the royalties on an album. And that can be really, really expensive for an artist in the long run. And so we wanted to put something in the market that says, look, you can access your money, you pay a small interest rate, but we're not taking any of your ownership away from you. We're not taking any equity from you. You still own all your music. And that's one of the most important trends, is that artists stay in control of their creative property.
You're in Nashville, Tennessee, obviously. That makes me think country. As you look at the potential acts that could be utilizing the service, does it tend to cluster around a particular type of music, or is it anything? Do you have like heavy metal clients? Do you have kids entertainers?
We do. We actually have... we have clients in rock, we have clients in hip hop, we have EDM DJs, we have country artists, we have pop artists. We're across the board at this point. You know, Nashville itself has expanded well beyond country, although it still is the hub for country. But our service serves artists of all genres, and this program is certainly available to any type of entertainer who goes on tour. So a comedian could leverage this, or you know, a traveling magician could leverage this. Anybody who has booked shows with guarantees attached to them and they're going out on the road to entertain people and perform, they can participate in this program.
Is this a reflection of the need of artists to have a higher level of sophistication around how their businesses are run?
I think so. I think it's important for every artist, no matter where you are in your career, starting out or extremely successful, to pay attention to the business and the principles of business and good business and be strategic. There's technology available, and there are certain programs like this one that we've launched that give the artist the ability to stay completely in control and make strategic decisions about how they run their business. Some of the more traditional business deals that still exist out there can be very constraining for an artist and can limit where they can perform, or it can limit what they're able to do to promote their album or their work. And so I think it's incredibly important that artists are very invested and interested and participating in their own businesses.
They have to become quadruple threats, it sounds like. Matt, thanks. Thanks for telling us about the program today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Matt Ermey is founder and chief strategy officer at Artist Growth. He joined us from Nashville, Tennessee.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Attention parents, now is the time to start talking about your legacy with your children. By 2050, it's estimated that approximately $40 trillion will end up in the accounts of Generation Z. This will be the largest intergenerational wealth transfer on record and will inevitably shift how resources flow into the charitable sector. Here to tell us more is philanthropic advisor at Karma and Sense, Gina Rothstein. She joins us from Comox, British Columbia. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Nice to hear your voice.
This is a massive, massive intergenerational shift, a huge wealth transfer. How is that going to affect the charitable sector?
It's going to affect the charitable sector in a number of ways, specifically in how quickly money will be flowing and the way that money will flow, in large part because the kids that are about to inherit this money don't look at philanthropy the same way as their parents. And they make decisions very differently from their parents. And so we're going to see traditional check writing go the way of the dodo, so to speak, and more integrated and iterative types of giving take hold. And what I mean by that is conscious consumerism, so retail philanthropy. There'll be more thought given to portfolio management and how assets are actually being used to create social change, the types of businesses that this generation is going to start or have already started will not just have social good off the side of the marketing desk, but it'll be integrated into the actual business model. And then specifically when it comes to women, because women outlive men, the way that women make decisions are more relationship-based. And so the timeline for writing large checks to charities is going to be extended because women tend to build relationships first before they make these larger gifts. And so you're going to see it manifest itself in a whole bunch of different ways.
There is a perception that the younger generation is more risk-tolerant than Gen X or baby boomers. First, is that accurate in your view? And second, how does that affect where they will put their charitable funds?
So there's some interesting research that's come out of the University of Waterloo around risk tolerance in this generation. And in fact, it's every generation at that age bracket are more risk tolerant because that's how their brains are wired. What's different about this generation in particular is the access to the tools that they have that allow them to take these risks. So in previous generations, we didn't have the types of technologies that are available now. And so the way that risk is manifested is different than how it is manifested now. I think what is even more telling is we've raised a generation or in the process of raising a generation where ideas are the commodity. And it's not just about the things in the ground that we can extract and resell, but really what are the things that can be created in our brains and manifested by using already existing technologies to create new stuff. And so this coming generation has higher risk because the types of things that are being created are their own ideas. And the way that we choose to value those ideas is somewhat nebulous. I mean, you just have to look at the things that come out of the Silicon Valley.
Right. Is Facebook really that much worth that much?
Exactly.
Fill in app there. There's a phrase, time, talent, and treasure, that people have been talking about in philanthropy for many, many years. There's the intergenerational wealth transfer, which is the treasure. How will Gen Z engage on the time and talent front that might be different from their parents?
Well, and then this generation also has ties, which is the first time that we've actually put a value against the network, the social network. And that's really where this generation's core value, at least their perception of their value, is. And so how many connections do you have on LinkedIn, and how do you leverage connections is just as valuable as the talent and the that they bring to the table. So right now their treasures are somewhat limited because they're in the process of making money and growing their wealth. The time that they contribute is very episodic. So they're interested in short bursts of really cool things that they can do, but commitments to boards and to long-term engagement is, it's not that it's not important, it's that they want to be able to see the results really quickly. And so sitting on a board to design something that could take years to execute is not really in their wheelhouse. But in large part, it's also because they're busy building their own stuff right now. And so making a commitment to a board is not in the same way that the Gen Xers, Gen Yers, or baby boomers had time to do. And then the talent that they bring to the table, well, it's funny because a lot of these younger kids think that they should be the CEOs of everything, in large part, again, because we've said that ideas are valued and there's ways to leverage those ideas. And so their expertise is actually tied directly to how they ideate and how they create new stuff out of stuff that already exists.
How did the incumbent charities need to change? Because there are many that are starting now that are designed with these kinds of things woven into the fabric of how they operate. But for, you know, the old, I don't know, the Cancer Society or the Hospital Foundation, ones that have been around for 100 years, what do they need to do differently in order to attract at least their fair share of that wealth transfer?
I think that they need to look at how they do their investments. So let's pick on the healthcare one. Let's pick on the healthcare one. So these are organizations that are behemoths, but one of the things that they do really well is they invest in research. So what would it look like in a philanthropy 3.0 era where instead of going out and raising money for galas, they took that research and created a bunch of different medical funds where their research is driving the investment strategy of those funds, such that instead of me writing a check to the Heart and Stroke Foundation or the Cancer Foundation or whatever, where all these different illnesses are actually interconnected because they're health-related, I actually took my money and invested in these health-related funds that are driven by the research that are financed by these charities that are doing fundraising, and then that asset base flips around and reinvests back in those charities to continue doing the research. So you're using my investment dollars, my risk tolerance, my liquid capital, and not giving me a tax receipt at the end, but you're actually allowing me to grow my portfolio and grow the charity's portfolio at the same time.
The metric that people have been focused on in the last decade has been looking at administrative costs as a percentage of the total. So how efficient are my dollars being used? Your process is much more sophisticated in how you analyze charities. What are some of the other things that you look at that you believe to be important in this question of whether or not money should go there?
So we look at charities the same way you would look at doing either an angel investment or any kind of other type of acquisition or purchase. So look at the leadership. Are the right people sitting in the right seats on the bus? The quality of programs and how they're being implemented. What are their peers saying? Who else is playing in the sandbox and how do they integrate with those who are already in the sandbox? Because duplication in the sector is real. Do they understand that there is a marketplace in which they're operating in, which is also very interesting if you think about it? What is their HR? What are their HR policies? How are volunteers engaged? Everything that has to do with as if you were going to be investing in a business, we look at it within the charitable context. finances is definitely part of it. But if we only look at the cost of raising a dollar to the program implementation, we don't actually fully understand what the cost of not solving that problem is. And I would sooner give to an organization that has higher overhead and lower recidivism than an organization that has low overhead but high recidivism.
Right. What does recidivism mean?
Recidivism is when the same user has to keep coming back for repeat services.
I totally knew that. I was just asking for you to confirm for listeners because, you know, they might not know. But I totally knew. Gina, I'm just kidding. That's the time we have. Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for this opportunity.
Gina Rothstein is with Karma and Sense. She was here to talk about this massive intergenerational wealth transfer that's going to happen with when Gen Z walks into their inheritance sometime in the next couple of decades. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolah La, we'll talk about the barriers facing millennials when it comes to investing. The director of the OSC's investor office, Tyler Fleming, will be here. And later, we'll look at The Answer Is, a website that provides young people with straightforward advice to invest successfully without all the wah-wah-wah acronyms and jargon. You can email us any questions that you have or any comments that you have. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Despite younger generations being perceived as risk takers, millennials often adopt a cautious approach when it comes to personal finance. According to a new report from the Ontario Securities Commission, millennials are feeling overwhelmed by investing and don't know where to begin. Here to tell us more is Tyler Fleming. He's the director of the investor office at the Ontario Securities Commission. He joins us from Toronto. Hello, Tyler.
Hi, Bruce.
I should say off the top that I was one of the consultants that helped bring this research together. It was a great project. I want to step back and ask you, why the focus on millennials?
Sure. So back in 2017, we actually conducted another piece of research called Missing Out, Millennials in the Markets. And that had a variety of interesting findings. Probably one of the headlines was that while 4 in 5 millennials are saving, only 1 in 2 are investing. We've discovered some interesting information about some barriers to why millennials might not be investing, including not knowing enough, fear of losing money, and low trust in the industry. And these raised a number of questions for us. You know, what does investing mean? What are their preconceptions? Where and from whom do they learn? And what can stakeholders do to help? So that was our first study, and that led us to conduct another study this year, which, as you mentioned, you were involved with, that looked at some of the behavioral barriers and ways to address them.
You did that quant research, as you mentioned. Why did you decide to focus on qualitative research, the interviews, behavioral insights? Why this approach?
Sure. So behavioral insights is an area of focus for the investor office and the OSC. You know, that's really about looking at how people behave in ways that are often not deliberate or rational in their decision making, in the way that traditional models or policy making assumes. It's really about getting at human behavior and why people act the way they do in certain situations. So we wanted to take a deeper dive and look at some of these questions, and there's a variety of research methods that we took and that you were involved in and gave us some really interesting insights and actions for stakeholders to take.
When I talk about this research, what millennials say are the two obvious reasons why they're not investing: the price of real estate and precarious job market. And what we found was that even people who have great and secure jobs, even people who live in low-cost parts of the country, have similar hurdles. What for you are the most resonant when it comes to this demographic?
Well, I mean, first I should say we've all read the articles that appear all over the place in terms of millennials and their behavior and how they're impacting, you know, the markets and the economy. And there's a tendency, I think, to generalize and to oversimplify. So, within the millennial cohort, there are a lot of different behaviors and characteristics. But I think you mentioned a couple of things that the millennials do tend to be more conservative with their money. And so even though they're doing a good job saving and looking after various financial priorities, there is a conservatism when it comes to investing in particular. I think, again, not wanting to oversimplify There is much more of a focus among millennials on their peers and what others are doing and how they compare, and that in turn affects their behavior as well.
One of the outcomes, we're going to talk about it in a second, are design principles for stakeholders. But before we talk about the specifics, I want to ask you about what role you believe the OSC has to play here, because it's not like you run a startup and you can, you know, come up with a super cool app that's going to scrape the data. That's not what the OSC's role is. So what is the role of the OSC here?
Well, there's a couple of things. So one, we do have an important function when it comes to educating investors. Our investor website is getsmarteraboutmoney.ca, where people can access hundreds of articles, tools, and calculators and other resources to help them better manage their money. But with this research, we wanted to actually have a focus on providing actionable and practical steps that stakeholders, including the financial industry, could take to address some of these barriers that we've identified. So we're hoping to facilitate the development of products and services that are innovative and help foster efficiency in the capital markets, and in turn help millennials who should be investing better do so.
What are some of the complexities of how that role works in the marketplace? And I ask because I can imagine some, you know, heads of product development thinking, you don't know what you're talking about. You're a regulator. Let me run my business as I know how to run it.
Right. So I think stakeholder consultation is an important part of our work here, and facilitating different discussions at different levels. As part of this research, as you know, we actually tested some of the research findings and insights before we published them with an industry roundtable. And we did find that not only did the findings resonate, but they were going to be useful for the industry in actioning.
One of the design principles is around trust, inspiring trust by putting users' needs first. One of the things I often talk about is the inherent conflict of interest that exists between the needs of the retail investor and of the institutions that serve the retail investor. How do you reconcile those conflicts?
Yeah, so I think it did come through in the research that millennials are very focused on getting advice from people who have their needs top of mind. And so, you know, as a result, they're drawn to anyone who is perceived as not having anything to sell them, or at least have putting their interests first. So I think that affects how, you know, the market and industry can position their products and services, how they should actually design them, and in turn have those conversations with younger investors.
So social comparisons was a big theme here. And I mean, the cliche version is that millennials all grew up with Facebook. They may not even be on it anymore because they're too cool for school for that. But they certainly have a different sense of their cohort than I did growing up. How do you leverage that? How do you use social comparisons to the good instead of people feeling like, you know, like I look at Instagram and I think I have the most boring life and I have the most hideous wardrobe ever compared to the people who are on that platform?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of millennials are digital natives. They've grown up with social media. They've grown up online. You know, you mentioned Instagram, but other social media, often people are presenting a very curated and selective point of view of their lives. But it nonetheless impacts how we see ourselves and our place in the world. So we need to recognize that millennials can be highly influenced by the perception of what their peers are doing and the results from those actions, but also recognize that they can be based on flawed or incomplete information. So when we're developing social comparisons to help millennials invest, I think it's important that it helps increase their motivation, but they also have to be realistic, right? You don't want to make social comparisons so unattainable or perceived to be so unattainable as to be discouraging.
I will never look like Kylie Jenner. No matter what I do is never going to happen for me. Not that it's my particular look, but it's never going to happen to me. One of the other things that you hear a lot, in particular from older people, is that the millennial investing results are not so much a generational factor, but a life stage factor. And that we should all just take a quaalude and wait for them to catch up in life stage and things will right themselves. How do you address that comment?
Well, I think there's multiple factors in it, but I do think it's important to recognize generational differences. You know, the people who grew up in the Great Depression had different saving and consumption and investing habits as the generation that followed. I think millennials, many of whom entered the job market during or after the Great Recession in 2008-2009, the market crashed, then they have a different outlook on life, right? And so I think it does impact decision-making. And as we talked about already, the environment environment they grew up in, digital, native, social media, all that sort of stuff, affects how people interact with the world and their perception of the world. So I think for sure there are life cycle issues, but we need to recognize generational differences as well.
You mentioned the Get Smarter About Money website. If someone were to want to go through the report in more details, what would be an easy way for them to find it, in particular the design principles that we outlined?
Sure. So on getsmarteraboutmoney.ca, if you look for the research section, you'll find all of our reports, including this one as well as last year's study, and it will outline the design principles.
Tyler, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Bruce. Always a pleasure.
Tyler Fleming is the director of the Investor Office at the Ontario Securities Commission. Coming up later, we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire with philanthropic advisor Gina Rotstein. But next, we'll talk about how young people can easily start investing. Maybe you're motivated now that you heard from Tyler. We're going to talk to David Jenkins. He is with The Answer Is. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
You are never too young to start investing, but it can be intimidating with experts seeming to speak a whole different language. Well, not everyone needs to make a career out of it. Some young people don't even know where to start. The Answer Is a could be a resource for you. It's a website offering young people knowledge and advice to invest successfully. Joining us now is the founder of The Answer Is, David Jenkins. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Thank you very much for having me.
Why did you start this? What was your vested interest?
Well, it's my attempt to give back, actually. My father was in the RCAF, the Air Force.
Yep.
And he died in the line of service. And so my mom raised four boys on her own. But part of the benefit package was that we had our entire university paid for. Tuition,
wow.
Books, we were paid to go to school.
Wow.
And so because of that education and some good luck, I've been very fortunate. And so this is my attempt to try to give back to all Canadians.
So you have built this site. I've checked it out. Who are you focused on? Who are you trying to speak to?
It's primarily targeted towards the younger generation, 18 to 35, is most applicable. Although what's interesting is I get people signing up, they register, and a week or two later, I see their parents registering. So,
wait, that's not allowed.
I know, it's interesting because the kids are bringing
get
their parents.
Get out of the rec room,
exactly.
Kids space. What about it is unique in the space that and different from all the other blogs and all the other newspapers and all the other everything that's already out there?
It's really designed to share just the basic amount of knowledge that you need to invest. That's my argument. You don't need that much information to invest. And it's more about the aptitude or headspace to be able to successfully invest. And I share strategies and philosophies primarily through story. So it's not a technical site. I tried not to make it a boring site. So the stories, by and large, are short and impactful. And I think that's what makes it a little bit different.
Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, sure. One of the stories on the website is Sue. She's 25. She's graduated. She just started working. She's decided she's going to start saving $200 a month or $2,400 a year. And but then she says, you know what? I might just wait 1 year because, you know, I like to go out on Thursday night and Friday night. Or
wow, go Sue.
Exactly. I like to have my tall cappuccinos with whatever. And she says, you know, I've earned it. I'm going to wait just 1 year to begin my investing. Well, by waiting that 1 year, Sue will have forfeit $99,000, which is more than the 40 years of $2,400 she was going to invest. So simply by delaying 1 year, it becomes extraordinarily expensive. So basically, Sue's fallen into the youth trap, as I call it, which is, failing to invest today because you'll get to it tomorrow.
You will get universal head nods for that anecdote. One of the other pieces of the puzzle, though, that might not get universal head nods is number two, beware of financial advisors. What do you mean?
Yeah, okay. So basically, the cost of advice is very significant, and it's very valuable for some people. If you have zero interest, zero aptitude, zero knowledge, and you don't ever want to get involved, I would strongly recommend finding a good qualified financial advisor, primarily charging on an hourly basis as opposed to percentage of assets basis. But most fund advisors, like mutual funds, for example, the average fee in Canada is over 2%. And it doesn't sound like a very big number, but 2% over a long-term investment horizon can chew up over 50% of your portfolio value just by itself, just the fees. And so the cost of fees is a very major consideration in any young investor's life.
Mm. Puzzle piece number one. You say mankind. I'm going to say humankind.
Okay.
Because it's my preference. Humankind's greatest discovery. I don't know what that is. What is that in an investment context? Is it fire? Is it sourdough bread or chocolate? That's what I would nominate.
It's more mundane than that, unfortunately.
Okay.
And actually, the label came from Einstein. And Einstein, as many of your listeners will know, is probably the most renowned physicist of our time. He gave us, theory of special relativity, general relativity, quantum physics.
Is that why I should forgive his use of gendered language?
Perhaps because it was before his time,
right,
we have to cut these people
time.
A little bit of slack.
Yes.
So Einstein's the source of it. And basically, he's saying that compound interest is mankind's greatest discovery. And I guess the reason why I sort of add that to the website is you don't have to listen to me or your professor or anybody else about what's the really important ingredient of investing. But you might want to just stop and think about what Einstein said, because he's arguably one of the most intelligent people that ever walked the planet.
One of the ongoing debates that people, young people have is, well, everybody has, but young people in particular, is whether they should focus on a TFSA or an RRSP when it comes to saving for retirement. Where do you lean?
Well, for young investors, I'm pretty clearly on the TFSA side because until you max out, the order of importance, I would say, is you max out your TFSA and then you would max out your RRSP and then you would begin your non-registered accounts. One of the major reasons you'd go TFSA is there's quite a bit of flexibility in it, which is also one of the drawbacks of going with your TFSA. But also it doesn't impact your OSA or your old age security.
Yep, OAS.
Way down the chute. So TFSA, I would say, is first, followed by RRSP.
Risk and you is another piece of the investor puzzle. By the way, for you, you have to go to the site to see how this all comes together, but they're actual puzzle pieces and they all fit together. Risk and you is one of them. What do you want young people to know about risk?
Well, risk is kind of like a pretty boring topic, quite frankly. But
not if you're bungee jumping and skydiving and parachuting. That's awesome.
You should take that into consideration for sure. But, part of the headspace about risk and volatility, quite frankly, is to understand the difference. Mm. A lot of people think risk and volatility is the same thing. It's not.
How would you define the difference?
I would say this. Volatility is not risky unless you begin to sell or you need to withdraw money.
Right.
So, but risk is a permanent loss of capital. So if you can put yourself in as a young investor, if you step back and say, I'm going to invest for a minimum of 10 years, preferably longer. I'm only going to buy large capitalization ETFs that are well diversified. Then you've managed to mitigate the majority of risk. And all you have left is volatility. But at that point in time, volatility becomes your friend, because as the market drops 20%,
right,
the shoes you're going to buy, at $100 are now $80.
Right.
You can buy those ETFs at $80 instead of $100.
And when you look at the chart, it looks like a jagged mountain range, and that is as it should. So a market pullback shouldn't make you upset.
No, it really shouldn't. As a matter of fact, we should really fully expect over the course of an investment horizon for most people, 30, 40, 50 years, we should fully expect drawdowns or market declines of 20 to 50% at least two, three, or four times.
Well, and we're in a ridiculously long bull run. I can't believe that it hasn't happened sooner. Something's going to happen. Who knows if it's a year or 5 years down the road, but markets don't go up in one onward march higher indefinitely.
Correct. And I echo your comments. It is going to drop. It'll drop 20 to 50%. That's one of the only guarantees I will give. I have no idea when it's going to happen.
The answer is the site. David, thank you for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you very much for your time, Bruce.
David Jenkins is the founder of The Answer Is. Coming up next, we're going to learn more about Canada's new medical marijuana program from Manulife Financial and Shoppers Drug Mart. And we'll take philanthropic advisor Gina Rothstein through the Moolala questionnaire. We're on the radio today hanging out, but I also do a lot of TV. So if you want to check out some more of the material that I've done on that front, go to cityline.ca and search for me. I've got lots of segments dating back over the last couple of years. Stick around. We will be back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Legalization of cannabis is just around the corner in Canada, but many people dealing with a variety of ailments have been using it for years, often without the financial support of their drug plan. A new program from Manulife Financial and Shoppers Drug Mart is working to provide a more comprehensive approach to medical marijuana. Here to tell us more is Donna Carbell, SVP Group Benefits at Manulife. She's in Waterloo, Ontario. Hello there.
Hi there.
Tell us how this plan is going to work.
Well, the Manulife Medical Marijuana Program is really, it's the first in Canada, as you say, that offers a comprehensive case management through Shoppers Drug Mart. The medical marijuana dispensing coordination is done through Shoppers, point of sale claims processing, and there is a terrific patient support oversight and outreach program.
What is new? Because you had already had some coverage in the past, is that right?
That's right. Medical marijuana was always available through what's called a healthcare spending account. But that's not really, wasn't really meeting our plan sponsors' needs. They were really looking for a program that offers a controlled, responsible, and caring way for plan sponsors to support their employees who are in need of relief from, you know, ailments like chronic pain or other serious discomforts that medical marijuana has some evidence to prove its viability with.
Now, previous coverage, there has been some quite focused areas. Pain, as you mentioned, arthritis, HIV, AIDS. What conditions will this new program cover?
Yeah, so we're going to start with conditions that have the greatest amount of evidence. So we're starting with things like stiffness, involuntary muscle spasms for folks that are suffering from multiple sclerosis, nausea, vomiting in people that are undergoing chemotherapy, and that chronic neuropathic pain is a big piece as well.
What is the, for the plan sponsors, I guess that's the employers, correct?
Yep, primarily. There are some plan sponsors that are large union groups, for example.
Is there a cost benefit to them or to the healthcare system when cannabis is used to treat issues versus traditional pharmaceuticals? So I wonder, here's a tangible example. Is cannabis cheaper than Xanax for treating anxiety?
Right. So it's a little early to say, and primarily because it hasn't been really widely covered under benefit programs. Plan sponsors are going to be adding new covered benefits, so costs they may increase quite seriously. But I think the controls that are included in the program, we have a prior authorization program, limits, that ongoing case management will help to ensure the cost is well managed, that there's not abuse in the system. But we do expect to be able to demonstrate over time that the use of medical marijuana in patients, really should parallel a decrease in the use of more conventional treatments such as opioids. It's just a little early to tell at the moment.
What is the cultural shift that is required for this to see uptake in not just in the healthcare world, but in workplaces? Because many of us, me, I'm a Gen Xer, there was really no difference between cannabis and heroin when I was growing up. It was all one and the same, and you were going to the dark side of hell if you did anything. So yeah. That isn't the case, not only when it comes to medical marijuana, but even recreational marijuana has been demonized in the past. What kind of cultural issues are we talking about?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think medical marijuana has been a valid treatment option in Canada for a number of years. It is recognized under Health Canada through the access of cannabis for medical purposes. But I think the advent of the recreational legalization has really kind of brought it to the forefront as a more acceptable treatment. So we have had very little uptake to date on accepting medical marijuana. However, I think a lot of that is because it's such a challenging environment for patients to work through. You know, there's over 90 different licensed producers, hundreds of different strains.
Wow.
And sponsors are struggling with ensuring that they're providing sort of a safe environment. So when you ask about the culture, I think plan sponsors, employers are also working through things like ensuring that they have introduced medical marijuana into procedures, human resource programs, that kind of thing. And there's a whole body of work that has to happen with the employer to be able to work through that. But I mean, I think it's changing, and I think that it's a new treatment option out there, and I think like any other new treatment, it'll take a little time.
Does it get into the hands of patients in the same way as a prescription drug does? As in, does your physician need to write you a prescription for it in the same way?
It's similar, a little different. So because it doesn't have a drug identification number, it's not actually a prescription. So physicians will write a recommendation. So they'll fill out some medical documentation to recommend medical marijuana. But it does have to be by a licensed practitioner. And then from there, prior to this program, there are these 90 different licensed producers, and those producers dispense medical marijuana through mail order. So tomorrow with this program, what we're hoping to do is provide that controlled environment where the patient, the physician will write that medical document. The physician or the patient will contact Manulife, provide that documentation, and Manulife will assess the submission and then connect him with the Shoppers Drug Mart case management program, who will then help to coordinate with the drug dispensaries, and it will still be dispensed by an authorized and properly licensed producer and coordinated home delivery.
How does cannabis differ from other drugs? You don't worry about popping a Lipitor as you walk to your desk, right? Whereas you would if you were consuming medical marijuana, that might affect your performance at the office.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it's very new. There are lots of guidelines and documentation through Health Canada on medical marijuana, who should be taking medical marijuana, who should not be. There are different methods. I think we all think of sort of smoking, but there's other oils and ingestions and capsules, and there's different methods that are also coming online and provide that faster relief. I think in terms of the impact to the workplace, really, if medical marijuana is proven to be effective with a particular patient and reduces some of that chronic pain, we actually think there'll be a positive impact in mm-hmm. terms of absenteeism and productivity in the workplace.
Fascinating stuff. Donna, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Donna Carbell is SVP Group Benefits at Manulife. She joined us from Waterloo, Ontario. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. This is our series of questions about money and a little bit about life. Gina Rothstein is our guest. She is a philanthropic advisor with Karma and Sense. And Gina, the first thing that comes to your mind, are you ready?
Yes.
How would you describe your money personality?
I would describe my money personality as a conscious consumer.
Was it ever thus, or is that a reflection of what you do for a living these days?
It's an evolution. It's not just a reflection of what I do for a living, but as I've become more aware and more in control of where my money goes and how it's being used, I'm very conscious about the ripple effect.
What are areas in which you notice yourself being more conscious than perhaps other people in your peer group? Is it organic food? Is it where you spend your entertainment dollars? What's the sector where it's like, got to really pay attention here?
I really pay attention to buying local. So organic food is whatever, but really focusing in on supporting small businesses and family businesses. And I think that if we start to support the communities that we live and work every day, we actually can make more difference than if we are constantly trying to buy the fast fashion from you know, the Philippines or wherever.
Is there harder areas to do that in? I can imagine fashion or clothing being a hard one in that the cost difference is so pronounced. It's one thing to pay a little bit more from, you know, the pie that was baked at the neighborhood bakery than the one from the big box grocery retailer. But when it comes to, you know, buying a jacket locally, that could be five times as much as the one imported from Asia.
So true. And I probably shouldn't have used fashion because I hate shopping anyway.
Well, that makes it easier for you.
It makes it a lot easier for me. But I am conscious about, I think that there's artistry that goes into things, right? And so, yes, I will go to the Gap and I will buy a t-shirt. Also, I know, right? How can you beat a 40% off deal?
Yep, it's true.
But then I will also go to a shop like Under the Bridge or, I don't know, SB or wherever, where, yes, the designers are not from Calgary, but the shop owners and everything that has to do with that shop, they support the local businesses in their neighborhood. Like, the ripple effect is
the profit's
there,
not going back to San Francisco.
Not entirely.
Who was your money mentor growing up?
Oh my goodness, I had a few. Some of them I listened to, and some of them.
Let's say mentor only means people you will listen to, or they were your cautionary tales.
They were my cautionary tales, right? Exactly. So my parents instilled really good money values in me. My dad always said to pay yourself first. And so that has definitely been instilled in me. And I think when I look at, it's not even when I was younger, even now, like I'm part of Rotary. And some of the guys in Rotary, they've seen success and fails in their business, and they're so open about it. And so you just have to learn from them as well, right? Like, I've had a few, and they're in different contexts.
If you landed a huge financial windfall, and I'm saying that's $25 million, what would you do with it?
Well, first I would buy a piece of property.
Where?
That I would never get rid of.
Where?
I think I would stay in Calgary.
Okay.
I wouldn't buy any recreational property. I would just buy like a piece of property that I know.
$25 million. These days you could buy the Bow Tower for that amount of money.
No, I know, but I wouldn't not know. That's, I would just use a little bit to buy the property.
Okay, all right.
And I think I would just.
A storefront in Inglewood.
Yeah, something like that. I probably would just invest it. I live really modestly, so it's kind of interesting. I still drive a car I think the car is now 12 or 13 years old. I've only, in my entire life, I've bought two cars. Like, I'm pretty.
Yeah. All right. Well, so you've spent $1 million. I guess that's $24 million to a foundation then.
Well, or some sort of investment.
If you could snap your fingers, you wouldn't give it all away. You're a philanthropic advisor, not a saint, for goodness sakes. Jeez.
Exactly. Maybe I'll go shopping. Maybe I'll
go shopping. Yeah, but you go to Milan and buy local in Milan.
That's what I should do. Exactly it. Are you going to come with me? Please?
Absolutely. I'll carry your bags. Are you kidding? Easy. Last question. If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
In society.
Yeah. I'm giving you a lot of power here.
Wow. So there's a few things. One is I want to change tax legislation around charities. I think it's ridiculous that we issue tax receipts for donations for organizations that underperform. And I think that if we could change the tax policy such that instead of issuing a tax receipt at point of donation, we gave it at point of actually doing something. We would have better results in the charitable sector.
Wow.
Can I do one other one?
You can.
Because it's like the same, it's along the same lines. We have an amazing social security blanket in Canada. And it's because of that we can pretty much go anywhere without having to worry about being robbed or being mistreated in some capacity. And I think it's in large part because we take care of our poor. And we might not do it to the phenomenally well, but we do it much better than in a lot of other parts of the world. And I think that we need to go back to why have we chosen to offload some of this stuff to charities when it really should still be under the arms of the government? And how do we as a society make that important enough? Because right now I think we're seeing a shift, and taking care of other people is becoming less and less important.
Clearly, you have a political run in your future.
I don't have a political run. I don't have thick enough skin.
Either that or you have a terrible past. You have dirt in your past, I think.
I've got way too many skeletons in my closet.
Gina, thank you very much for your time. Gina Rothstein, philanthropic advisor with Karma and Stents. That's our show for today. If you want to listen to more Moolala, you can go to our website, moolala.ca, or head on over to iTunes where you can download the podcast version of this show, write a review, or subscribe so the next episode just shows up on your device. Hey, are you in a book club? I know. Book clubs, they always read fiction, but how about changing it up just this once and bringing some Moolala into your book club? You can find the book online. You can go to the library and get it. There's a discussion guide for your book club to use. How cool would that be? Thank you very much for joining us. Have a great day.